And welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast. My name is Father Gregory Pine. This is an off-campus conversation, which began as a way of following up with Thomistic Institute speakers after they had given lectures on campus, but has become more freewheeling and free-dealing, affording me the opportunity to just have conversations with people who have interesting insights into all manner of knowable things. So I'm delighted for this episode to be joined by Professor Thomas Hibbs. Thanks so much for joining.
Glad to be here.
So I first came across you / learned from you in picking up a couple of the books that you wrote. The year that I was assigned in Louisville, Kentucky, I had like 2 hours and 15 minutes in the morning to study. And so I was working on virtue theory, and I profited from the book on metaphysics in action and then virtue splendor. It was like one of your footnotes in Virtue Splendor about the gifts of the Holy Spirit, which convinced me that I didn't really know anything about the subject and that I probably should stop declaiming as if I did. So thank you for occasioning and causing humility in me. But also, you know, a great contributor to Things Thomistic Institute, whether conferences or lectures on campus or supporting the chapter there at Baylor. So most recently, how are things? And I suppose, what are things? What are the things in which you are involved at present, because it looks like you're somewhere far away from Waco, Texas.
I'm not far from you, just down the road, right, in D.C. Second summer in a row that I've been running a program for Baylor undergraduates. We've got 12 students here this summer on religion and public life, and the students are in internships, and then we have academic seminars for them and spiritual reflection, sort of ecumenical spiritual reflection, because we've got students from a variety of denominations. And then helping them to try and discern and think more deeply about vocation. We start every morning with a period of silence for the students, and that's sometimes even just 5 minutes of silence can be really challenging. But at least last summer, the students all reported that it was one of the best things parts of the summer was just learning to start the day in silence, which then led into prayer and conversation. So doing that, and after 20 years in administration, I've been back at Baylor full time as a teacher and scholar for 3 years now, and really glad to be back on the front lines in academia, in the classroom full time, and really glad to continue to be part of all of the things that the Thomistic Institute does. I think the combination of, in fact, I had something like the Thomistic Institute mind for part of what we're doing with this Baylor summer program, this bringing together of things that are disconnected in our wider culture and even in our churches, of serious academic intellectual reflection, but that's not constrained by academic questions, that where students can feel free to raise questions about how they're living, about their friendships, about their hopes for family and career and so forth, so that that serious intellectual reflection combined with prayer and combined with the kind of joy of our communal lives together, the cultivation of friendship in social settings, that hitting all of those the way the Thomistic Institute does is really exactly what we need in our culture, and it's exactly what college-age students need. So I continue to be really grateful for the work and this model that the Thomistic Institute has developed, and grateful to and honored to be part of it.
That's super generous. Thanks so much for saying that. Certainly on behalf of Father Dominic, cheers. I think that, how to say this best, I don't know that I'll say it best. I'll just say it in one way. But working in an academic setting, one kind of participates as it were in a guild. And so you want to abide by the life of the guild. You want to abide by the rules of the guild. And I think in academia, it seems like that guild mentality has drifted in a somewhat strained direction, perhaps in part because of publication pressures and tenure law and other things besides. But we're not always asking the questions that we're actually asking, because there's got to be like a lot of ground clearing and a lot of throat clearing and a lot of, you know, setting up, as it were. I think it's great what you highlight, that students feel free to ask the questions which actually inform their intellectual pursuits, but they're just kind of like human pursuits more broadly. Yeah. So maybe, yeah, our conversation can be pursuant to that. I was also struck with what you said about silence. There are certain ways in which, you know, like religious life spoils an individual, and that you don't realize what you have because you don't reflect upon it from a critical distance. But like, yeah, I mean, of the whatever number of hours I'm awake, 17 and a half hours I'm awake, maybe like 13 of them are spent in silence. Mm-hmm. Woo! it's a wild ride. So in prepping for this conversation, we thought we might talk a little bit about beauty. And maybe we can just start with the students' questions, or start with the students' experience. I think that like a lot of us live in an ugly world, or we live in a world characterized by artificial beauty. So like, you know, the individual gets up, does hair and makeup for 45 minutes and then snaps an apparently candid photo. Ugh, woke up like this. You know, it's like there's a lot of posturing and there's a lot of manipulating of images. But people continue to be attracted by beauty and in a certain sense, kind of like saved, renewed by beauty. How do you see this at work in a young person's life? I mean, in a person's life more broadly, like what are the ways in which beauty plays on us or invites us or calls us into something more noble?
Yeah, I think you made in passing there a really interesting point about the world we all live in, but especially the world that young people live in, which is a world of constantly constructed images. And there's a line in T.S. Eliot's early poem, Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, where Prufrock's a deeply alienated and hollow soul, right? But he keeps saying, there will be time, there will be time, which is a reference to Ecclesiastes, of course, but it goes in a different direction with Prufrock. And at one point he says, there will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. And that sense, I think, especially because of social media, that young people have of constantly trying to cultivate an image to present to others. And they also are sophisticated enough to know, I mean, we're all aware of the way algorithms are working on us on social media, but they're also aware that lots of people are out there trying to manipulate them. And they're if they don't have resources to guide them, it's a real kind of epistemological and moral crisis. What do I trust? Who do I trust? And yet there is, I think, in the encounter with what is authentically beautiful, there's a sense in which we are, unlike Prufrock, who's always collapsing in on himself, and what we're tempted to do, I think, in our own culture, there is in the experience of beauty something that is arresting, something that makes us stop and pause. And there's also both, with that, there's also a kind of self-forgetfulness in the encounter with beauty. I teach a moral philosophy course at Baylor, and I do it chronologically backwards. I start with Nietzsche, and we end with Plato, Aristotle, and Aquinas. But at one point, after we've done the modern thinkers, I have them read Iris Murdoch, who has a lot of deep criticisms of modern moral philosophy, a friend of Elizabeth Anscombe and Philippa Foote at Oxford. And she talks about the dilemma for us as being trapped in this construction of fantasies, the anxious, avaricious tentacles of the self. There's a big phrase for you to try and memorize. And that in one semester, that phrase became a rallying cry for my class, that professors, we haven't talked about the anxious, avaricious tentacles. And I was really glad to see the students latching on to that, because it's a kind of counter to this notion that of everything's just about self-expression. Right. And the danger really is that we warp how we see the world and how we see others through our own fantasies, through our own self-serving fantasies. And so then Murdoch goes on to talk about strategies for what she calls unselfing, for freeing yourself from the avaricious tentacles. And one of them that she mentions, in addition to academic study, where we have to meet standards like learning a language, that I can't just make it up. I actually have to judge myself according to objective standards. One, she says, is beauty. The experience of beauty, because the authentic experience of beauty is something that pulls us out of ourselves. It, in a way, frees us from ourselves. It allows us to also rest in an object, in an experience that's an end in itself, right? And there we're back to the language that Aristotle and Aquinas use when they talk about the good or the end of human life. the good or the end, we can have lots of instrumental goods where they help us to get to something else. But the ultimate end is an experience of something that's desirable for its own sake. And we desire it no matter what other good comes from it. We all have experience of this. Friendship is an experience of this. You like being with your friends, not because you're going to get some extrinsic good out of it. And beauty is an experience like this. It's an experience of something that you say, well, why do you like beautiful things? It's hard to know what to say to someone who's asked that question in a skeptical way, just as it's hard to know what to say to someone who says, why do you like spending time with friends? There's something self-evident about that derives immediately from the experience that says this is something that is fitting to my soul. So when Aquinas says that in his very succinct and non-theoretical, it's just an observation about the experience, when Thomas says beauty is that which when seen pleases, right? It's a very succinct statement. And he's saying there, this is something that you rightly take delight in, the beautiful. And it's something that you can rest in, so that at times he will compare the experience of the beautiful to the contemplative experience, right? These are both about ends that are desirable for their own sake. They refresh the soul. As Maritain says at one point, in the experience of the beautiful, we hearken back to the terrestrial paradise, where there seems to be a momentary harmony between us and the world, right? Where there's a fittingness between both our cognitive and our volitional or affective capacities, right? Because when seen pleases. So the definition of the beautiful is bringing together the cognitive, the perceptive, the awareness of something, also with the affective or the volitional. This pleases. So there's something fitting and appropriate to our nature in the experience of the beautiful. And at a time, if we could go back to silence and rest, the experience of the beautiful is in the midst of a very utilitarian and noisy world. The experience of the beautiful is something that says, stop, pay attention, be transformed, be transfixed by this particular object, at least for a time. So I think that the beautiful can play a really important role just in terms of natural goods, the rest of the soul, the sense that our faculties are in harmony with a certain object. And then, of course, it can play in those ways. It can play an instrumental role in the spiritual life, but it's also very important to the spiritual life. I mean, when Thomas talks about contemplation toward the end of the Secunda Pars, when he talks about the particular states of life and gives a defense of the Dominican life of contemplation overflowing into action, one of his chief authorities there is Gregory the Great, and Gregory says at one point, from the love of God, we are aflame to gaze on his beauty. Right? And that sense of God deriving from Gregory and Augustine and going back to Scripture, that God appeals to us both as true and good, but also as beautiful, that God is moving something in the depths of our soul that's longing for that which is beautiful without any hint of flaw.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe just by way of summarizing my own, I don't know that this would be summarizing what you've said, but it's kind of summarizing my thoughts that run concurrent to your descriptions. It's like, I suppose, you know, skepticism is a kind of foreclosure on the possibility of knowledge, and cynicism is a kind of foreclosure on the possibility of love. And it strikes me that both of those move in the realm of the util, you know, of use, because it's like, it's like transactional, it's commercial, and then we just try to do the best with what we have, but not in a prudent way, in a kind of mercenary way. Whereas it strikes me that like beauty is able to reach through because it unburdens itself of the appearance of the useful, and it impresses upon you that this is something else. This is pleasant, right? This is enjoyable. This is delightful. And that use or usefulness will have to be transcended. And it's almost in like the bewilderment of that paradigm shift or that movement up that you're like, how? And in asking those questions, like some of the settled territory of foreclosing on knowledge and foreclosing on love gets upset and it gets destabilized. And there's this kind of virginal, innocent experience of something else. And it's like, I have to make new judgments or at the very least, I have to account for the judgments of others that go before me. And it strikes me that, like, there's no guarantee that the beautiful will lead you to God, or that the beautiful will lead you to the good, you know, like broadly so called, because you can just be a kind of beautiful hedonist. But there is a sense in which it's always going to be a little bit upsetting, or it's always going to be a little bit destabilizing. And perhaps that's the reason for which people will often use it in kind of charismatic and apologetic discourse, saying, like, you got to upset people at the outset. You got to destabilize people at the outset, which I had never thought about in those terms, which is cool. There's an appeal to that, obviously.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. The other danger with beauty, one is a kind of hedonism. The other danger with beauty, I think, in more in kind of higher class upper level sort of high culture is aestheticization, right? Where you turn the appreciation, it might not be hedonistic exactly. It's very sophisticated. It's not concerned with immediate bodily pleasure, but where we detach completely any possible connection of the beautiful to the good and the true, or of the beautiful as destabilizing, right? Because one of the dangers of talking about the beautiful as disinterested in the way Kant does, there's something right about that, if you mean by that not to be instrumentalized for something else, right? But the disinterested view of beauty is sort of an offshoot of a strain of Kant that cancels out the what Plato would have called, and Aquinas does in places too, something like the erotic element of beauty, the sense that, and not in a Freudian sense, right, but in the sense that it's destabilizing. I'm finding myself pulled into something that is reorienting my desires and how I see the world. And so on the one hand, you can sort of go beneath reason and have a hedonistic experience of beauty, but you can also overly intellectualize it in the sense that you detach it from the desire for beauty and for the good. And I think you're absolutely right that destabilizing moment in the experience of something that is, in the modern world, we sort of, after Kant, we sort of distinguish between the beautiful and the sublime. That would fit with the sublime in some sense, right? The experience of an overwhelming beauty. Of course, we don't think that ultimately is about something that's irrational or violent, but the initial experience can be somewhat frightening, right? It can be fearful, as is clear in both the Jewish and Christian scriptures, right? That this experience of God is destabilizing. There's a sense of a presence that is at once beckoning us, but we're also overwhelmed by that presence. And the beautiful is a partial, a limited experience of that, I think, can be.
Yeah. It strikes me too, just thinking about St. Thomas's description and Maritain's exposition, they hearken to the kind of meeting of the sensible and the intelligible in beauty. It's like it appeals especially to sight and to hearing because they're the most intelligent of senses. But then there's an immediacy or a kind of urgency to the experience of the beautiful, which we would associate with sensible or with sensory exchange. And nevertheless, you know, because these elements of truth and goodness are at work in it, insofar as there's, you know, we recognize something intelligible, but we move towards it, as it were. There's a kind of ecstasy of recognition of something that completes me, that perfects me. So it's obviously it's something that appeals most wholly or most fully to intellects or to intelligences. But it strikes me that what you describe there is there's a risk of hedonism, but there's also a risk of aestheticism. That beauty is always going to be tough to pin down because it's always going to involve us in both universal and particular, right? It's always going to involve us in immaterial and material. It's always going to involve us as human beings being human beings. Like if we're tempted to angelism, if we're tempted to bestialism, beauty is going to always, it's going to prompt us to get back into our bodies and to our minds and hearts and to be there at the horizon of creation to experience the human thing which it furnishes. It's hard. It's hard work being a human being.
The other thing that's at play here is, I mean, Maritain says that one of the wonderful things about art and beauty is that it gives us what contemplation gives us, philosophical contemplation, let's say, without having to do all of the hard discursive work, right? I mean, when Aristotle talks about resting in contemplation, he has in mind doing a really long proof and then hitting the conclusion, right? Or mastering the physics, something like that. Whereas if you look at a beautiful work of art, granted, being educated and developing a vocabulary for Chartres Cathedral or something can really help you to appreciate it, but you can get a lot out of just standing in front of it and looking at it. And there's, as you said, the immediacy of it. It also comes as a kind of gift. And if you were to think about, well, how do I make sense out of this fact that there seems to be a fitness between these beautiful things, natural and artificial in the world, and my soul, how do I make sense out of that? That could lead you down a theological path.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's a matter of, yeah, being honest or being some manner of honest. I don't know exactly that any of us are capable of being wholly honest because we're always going to be a little bit bent back on ourselves, but being honest before that experience, you know, and then dealing with all of the things that happen in us, you know, like the physical things, the emotional things, the psychological things, because there's always a temptation to hold it off at arm's length. It's like, whoop, unmanageable.
Yeah.
Keep that away. Or, whoop, reveals things to me about myself that I don't like. Keep right. that away, or whatever else it is.
Right.
So there's, it seems like there's a kind of discipline or even an asceticism to that encounter with beauty, which places demands on us as human beings.
Absolutely.
Okay. So in thinking about this, you recommended that we look at a couple of beautiful things. So for those listening on your podcast app, you'll find links in the description or the show notes there, which you can follow to see an image or see a clip. We'll just see how far we get here in the conversation. But I suppose with anything along these lines, it's best to come and see rather than merely to describe at a certain distance. So is there a particular image or a particular clip from cinema which you think would be a good place to start?
Well, we could start with the Rembrandt painting, which is gone now. I mean, it was stolen in 1990 from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. There's a great multi-part Netflix documentary about this theft, this famous theft, which they never solved. And this is one of the paintings that was stolen, Rembrandt 1633, I think, Christ on the Sea of Galilee. And it's the disciples in the ship with Christ when the great storm and Christ is sleeping. Pope Francis gave a great, during COVID, a great Orbi et Orbi speech alone in Vatican Square, using that passage from the Gospel of Mark of Christ calming the sea in the middle of the storm. And Rembrandt, it's a dark painting, as many Rembrandts are, but there are flickers of light, and it's got the front of the ship. You can see off to your left as you're looking at it is taking on enormous wind and water, and you can see some of the disciples up there desperately trying to keep the sail straight and keep the boat from going under. If you enlarge it, you can also see about midway through, just about where Christ is, you can see one individual who is leaning over the side. It looks like he's getting sick on the side of the boat. I mean, he's either that or he's about to jump into the water. And then Christ is sitting very calmly looking toward a few of the disciples and out toward this enormously violent storm. But Christ is sitting, face absolutely placid, very calm, and that some of the disciples are gesticulating toward him. You know, you got to do something here. Help us out. But then right in the middle, you'll notice a character that I think if you count, there's one too many characters in the boat. And right in the middle is a character who's looking right at us. That's Rembrandt. So it's a self-portrait, which Rembrandt, we know, did famous self-portraits. But Rembrandt is placing himself in the scene. This, I think, comes a bit after, I'm going to refer to Jesuit spirituality here for a moment, if I can be granted permission to do that. But the meditation, you can find this in the Dominicans and the Franciscans as well. It's Ignatius formulating what was popular in the Middle Ages as the composition of place, right, in the spiritual exercises, where the idea is to place yourself in the presence of God and then place yourself into the setting of the scriptural scene. And there to immerse your senses, all of your senses, in attempting to experience everything that the people in the scene with Christ are experiencing. And this influences poetry, John Donne, George Herbert, and it influences painting. And you can see why particularly those who want to communicate a Christian message, might want us to avoid what we were just calling ascetization, right? The sense that I am a detached observer, and this really has nothing to do with me. I've got this scene under my control of my intellect and my will. Whereas the real experience of the beautiful, as we were just saying, is something that decenters you in a way, that calls you into the scene where you're in something bigger than yourself. So Rembrandt, in a way, by placing himself in the scene, is inviting us to do the same thing, right? And then the fact that he's looking directly at us, it's as if he's saying, okay, where are you in this scene? What, as if he's saying, what does this have to do with you, right? Or who am I to you, as Christ says to the apostles at various points. So it's a beautiful scene depicting the grave physical threat of this storm, Christ's placid calm, and then Rembrandt turning to the viewer and saying, come in. Don't remain out there just appreciating the excellent painting or just the elements of the scene. How would you be reacting if you were in this boat with Jesus? And what does Jesus's calm tell you about the storms of your life when you're in them? There's a whole reflective theological pedagogy that one could draw out of this from looking at a beautiful work of art that initially just captivates us because of the contrast between light and dark, because of the way in which we can almost feel ourselves in a boat that's at grave risk, and the way in which each of the individuals is responding in a different way to the threat of this storm and to the presence of Christ in their midst. So this is something that I think goes beyond, but it's subtle, right? I mean, it's not Rembrandt forcing you to see him in there. But if you look at it carefully, you're struck by this character who's looking right at you, right? Who's in fact looking back at you. There's a kind of icon element here, right? Not merely a painting as an object, but where the figures are, in a sense, looking back at you. It's not quite an icon in the traditional sense, but Rembrandt's using something like the strategy of an icon to pull us out of our detached relationship to a work of art and to invite us into this very dramatic scriptural scene so that we might appreciate the beauty, the threat, the fear, the trust, the calmness of Christ. And we might come to understand more beautifully through our appreciation of it, our relation to nature, our relation to others, and our relation to Christ.
So it strikes me that in the description that you give, Rembrandt serves as something like a witness. He's supplying something along the lines of testimony. And I recently read The Return of the Prodigal Son by Henri Nouwen, where he meditates at great length on that image, which he went to Russia to view for several days. But in the course of it, he describes something of Rembrandt's own life, and it sounds like he was lecherous as a youth and unfaithful as a middle-aged man and may have had something like a genuine conversion at the end of his day. So I'm thinking about like how trustworthy is the witness or like how faithful is the witness? Because it strikes me that this invitation, it works with greater efficacy to the degree or extent that the person is good, is himself responding adequately to the beauty which beckons. Maybe could you talk a little bit about that role?
Yeah, and that raises all sorts of tough questions, right? About, I mean, one of the things that, this is coming at it a little bit indirectly, but one of the things that Flannery O'Connor found liberating about when she read Maritain was that Maritain insisted, as Thomas and Aristotle do, that the good of art is the good of the work, right? It's not the good of the intention of the artist or the good of the soul of the artist. Now, what you're saying about a witness is a separate thing, right? That increases, I think, the pressure on the individual artist if he or she is going to speak as a witness to have a certain kind of character. But so art itself, I think, and Flannery found this, Flannery was certainly not advocating artists leading debauched, hollow lives, right? She tried very hard to lead a holy life. but she was also glad that sort of a platitudinous understanding of the intention of the artist, right? That she would get letters. Why can't you give us something uplifting instead of these murderers and thieves? So she found herself liberated by Maritain's claim that it's the good of the work of art. And in that sense, the good of the work of art can work on us without any reference to and without the artist being actually good, although they have to be able to tap into something. I think with Rembrandt, if I recall, and I think that's a wonderful book by Nouwen on that work of art. It's really a beautiful, sustained meditation. And he's doing what I think Rembrandt wants us to do, which is to keep coming back to the image and looking at details, right? But the so I think you're right that the witness, I think it at least requires a kind of humility on, I mean, I think he also depicts Rembrandt toward the end as having something more of substance conversion and as dealing with great financial strain, lack of fame in a sense, even though he had created these great works of art. And I think the other thing is that I don't think Rembrandt is, as a witness, he's pointing us to these followers of Christ who are all reacting in very different ways, right? And some with more trust than others. So I think he's also imagining a scale of audience members who might be at different distances from the truth being revealed in that scene in Scripture and in the painting. But I do agree with you that in the end, if you're going to be not just an artist, but a witness, that then that's got to come out of something rooted in the life of the artist and not just out of having a talent and an imaginative ability to reconstruct, say, a scene from Scripture.
Yeah. No, I think I've come across those comments by Flannery O'Connor in Mystery and Manners. I'd also come across something comparable in like Dorothy Sayers, when it was like one of the plays that she wrote, you know, you had these folks asking her how she selected the angels, whether it was because they were pious and devout or whether it was because, you know, they exhibited these or those virtues. She's like, no, I picked them because they were good actors, you know, so kind of highlighting there the difference between prudence on the one hand, which is perfective of agency, and then art, which is perfective of matter, which I think is super helpful. But yeah, there is this strange way in which artistry, it betokens something beyond, you know, so it, like it's not always that clean.
Yeah, sure.
Like you see people kind of working their way through this question when it comes to the work of Marco Rupnik.
Yes.
You know, it's like very problematic individual, very sinful individual. It's been proven, you know, and yet his artwork adorns like dozens of sanctuaries throughout the world. Or like you think about it in the like late Renaissance setting, like Il Sodoma, you know, like he's called what he's called for a reason. And yet, you know, he was patronized by the, you know, for the beauty of the thing. It's just, it's like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And there is a sense in which the more you know about really vilely corrupt individuals, I think it's really hard. And I don't know how much we should even make the effort to separate the things out. I mean, you could just be, particularly when it comes to, I mean, if you got a kind of vile individual who's just writing a nice story, right, that's captivating, or making a film that's sort of entertaining, fine. But if you get a really vile soul attempting to depict really holy things, it's easy to see how your repulsion and disgust every time you look at that by your inability to separate out the memory of who made this and how that person lives. So I think it does get really complicated in that way. And there, you know, there's a reason why we might want to remove things that are, even if they're intrinsically beautiful, that have been painted by really corrupt individuals, simply because we don't want that association when people are supposed to be elevating their mind to other things.
Yeah. How it becomes in turn inextricable. Okay. Well, let's turn maybe in a final example to cinema. You've written a book, Shows About Nothing, from which many have profited, about the kind of nihilism which undergirds a lot of modern entertainment, or I should say undergirds. That makes it sound like it's an actual building. Maybe undergirds is the wrong word, which vitiates. Yeah. But you make reference at various points in some Thomistic Institute lectures to a particular scene from The Lord of the Rings, which draws out some of the themes that we've been discussing to this point. Could you take us through that?
Yeah, and I do this. Let me give a little two background points on this. One is I usually use this scene in I sometimes give lectures on marriage in film. And I'll start with really disordered, although enlightening views of marriage in a film like The Ice Storm. I sometimes talk about marriage and disaster and affliction in Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. Which deals with the loss of a child, a son, not a child anymore. But and then I always end with this selection from Lord of the Rings that because I think it helps young people in particular recover something that's natural about dating and falling in love and marriage and children that our culture is sort of systematically suppressing. And the interesting thing about this scene is it is a scene that Peter Jackson added to the book. It's not in the book. So he and what I've heard, he and two female assistant directors were wondering about Arwen's motivation for, in a sense, sacrificing her life amongst the immortals to be with Aragorn, who's immortal and who will die. And in right before, not long before this scene in the that's added in the film, she meets with her father Elrond, who can see the future, and tells her, "There is nothing there for you with Aragorn, only death." And she's on a horse with a group going off to the Undying Lands. And suddenly, across her path runs a very long, blonde-haired young boy. And she is having, no one else sees this who's in her midst. In fact, she pauses on her horse, and one of the leaders of this journey says, "Arwen, there's no time. We must go." And she stops, and she has this vision of this young boy running across her path and then running and jumping up into the arms of Aragorn, who's clearly older. His hair is a bit gray. And she looks over at the boy in Aragorn's arms, and the boy looks at her, and then the boy turns and looks at Aragorn, and then looks back at Arwen. So Arwen and Aragorn's eyes never meet in this scene. They're linked by the eyes of the child. And it's really remarkable. The other footnote I'd add to this is that Hitchcock once said that film is not about dialogue. And you think, well, Hitchcock had much greater dialogue and screenwriting than we do today in most of our films. But Hitchcock said, and you can see this if you go back, which I started to do a few months ago, to his silent film period, where you didn't have a lot of dialogue except, and he tried to minimize the use of little screenshots of dialogue. He said, it's about showing a face, showing what the face is looking at, and then registering the change in the facial expression on the basis of what that person has seen. And this is, I think this is Jackson just picking up on the logic of film, right? There are no words, and Aragorn and Arwen don't, their eyes don't even meet. They meet through them both looking in to the eyes of the child that is an expression of their love. And so she turns around and speeds back on her horse to her father and says, "You saw the future." He said, "There's only death." And she said, "No, there is life. There is a son." And that motivation for her then is articulated in terms of the film of bringing new life into the world. So that, and I always ask the students, I say, you know, I was not the most romantic or well-ordered soul in the world. My wife could tell you this when we began dating. But one of the things that happens there just naturally as you're falling in love is a moment where you say, this is the person I want to have children with. And that I think used to be, and still is to some extent, a natural inclination. But ask yourself how many romantic comedies you've seen where anything like having, you get sometimes people who already have kids who come together, big families, right? But it's rare in our romantic comedies that all of the weird things that happen and then these two people decide they actually belong together. But it's really rare for an intrinsic part of that to be, I want to have children with this person. And that's what's going on in Lord of the Rings. And I think it's beautifully done. It gives young people, I think, an opportunity to recover those natural instincts and a way of articulating that, yeah, this openness to having children, this not just an openness, but this is what it means. Part of what it means to fall in love is to think, I want to have children with this other person. It's beautifully depicted without any dogmatic or moralistic heaviness in that scene from Lord of the Rings. It's a beautiful scene. It illustrates the logic of film, no dialogue, just eyes and faces looking back and forth. And it also is an occasion where film pulling from really rich sources in Tolkien and in the tradition can help us through what we see and feel recover something that's really important to the natural inclinations that we have as human beings.
Yeah. Yeah. So for a final question, as we wrap up, can we just think a little bit more about this non-moralistic moralizing? I talk often to Father Bonaventure Chapman is one of my classmates, and he pointed this out about David Foster Wallace. Like he'll say it, especially with respect to the essay, the title essay, and Consider the Lobster. It's like he just shows you something, or the essay that he writes about, like the Academy Awards of the porn industry. He just shows you something, and the tendency of the judgments which issue from that demonstration, right? That manifestation kind of communication it feels almost inexorable. It's like, yeah, I can't but judge this, or I can't but judge that, because it's been shown to you so clearly, like the static has been removed or the fog has been removed. But it strikes me that like beauty has a moralizing tendency, but it's just operating in a different mode than how we ordinarily moralize. Could you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there's this great short poem by Emily Dickinson. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight, the truth superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. It's just so beautiful on this topic, right? It's the Wittgenstein thing. Show, don't tell, right? Find, and the great artist, and Flannery knew this, right? It's about vision. It's about seeing more deeply into the phenomena that's in front of us. And too much of contemporary Christian art is just predictable and didactic. It's imitated. I mean, a lot of people want Christian art because so much of Hollywood art is so bad, but it imitates the worst part of Hollywood art in being didactic and preachy and predictable. And Walker Percy, Flannery O'Connor, all the great artists in the Catholic tradition know that it's about wonder and surprise. And it's about helping people to see things in a way that they had. So it might be the angle of the camera. It might be the lighting. It might be the way in which you reveal the sorrow beneath apparent happiness in certain kinds of characters, right? But show it, don't tell it. And let people have that discovery of what you see there for themselves. Trust the art and trust the viewer to get there, right? And that's the kind of trusting in the freedom that we sometimes don't want to do, but in art, you have to do it. If you're preaching or teaching, it's different. But in art, you really have to trust the artwork and the viewer. And you got to realize a lot of times it's just not going to work, right? But that's, again, to go back to Rembrandt, that's why Rembrandt sticks himself in there, right, as a last reminder. I'm looking at you. Come in. But that's not, he's not giving you a script for how you must think about your life. It's an image that you've got to grasp, and then you've got to respond to it and say, whoa, what's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah. Which lays claim or places demands. But only way to stay sane, as some band once sang in the mid-90s. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for furnishing the explanations. Thanks for showing and telling both insofar as it's appropriate to the medium.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoy it. Love the work you in particular are doing with these podcasts. And again, just really glad to be part of anything that the Thomistic Institute and the Dominicans are doing. Really grateful for your work.
Thank you. Thank you. If folks want to follow up with things that you've written or things that you've said, is there a good place to which they ought to turn?
So all of the things that I've written that are of a more popular vein, movie reviews, book reviews, art, are on thomashibbs.org. They're all collected there on my website. And so they could go there. And if they've got, you know, lots of free time or suffer from significant insomnia, it's highly recommended even without a prescription.
That's awesome. I was just describing to somebody how I learned the Dominican rite between 2 and 7 in the morning in a bout of especially bad insomnia. It can be good not to sleep. God brings great good out of great weirdness. So thanks. And then turning to you, the listener, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Off-Campus Conversations on the Thomistic Institute podcast. If you haven't yet, subscribe on YouTube or on your podcast app, unless you don't want to, or unless it's not good for you, and then do the opposite or do neither. Know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.